Hello, guys. Welcome back to the Health and Wellness Connection TV show. I'm your host, Dr. Barry Ruke. I'm here, hopefully, to bring to you some of the latest and greatest information in the health and wellness space. Of course, we are broadcasting live at AfroVibes TV Studios, located here in Houston, Texas. Now, first and foremost, I should say, I want to go ahead and extend apologies and, just let you guys know that, you know, we missed last week due to some issues in Texas, actually. I'm sure you guys have paid attention to the news, but there was a pretty terrible freeze all across the state. Just multiple outages as far as power and water throughout the state. I was affected as well. So that kind of really restricted our ability to produce content. So I just want to apologize for that as far as not having content for you guys last week, but we will get back on track. You know, we're back on it as we planned. We're back to, you know, full electricity. We're not running a generator anymore, so we're doing good, and we're going to keep pushing the content out to you guys to make sure we keep delivering that awesome content that you guys have grown to love. So again, this is the Health and Wellness Connection show, and we're going to start the show off this week on, of course, a favorite topic of mine and yours, I'm sure, probably not, but very important still, that is the coronavirus. Now, of course, the pandemic is still going on, and a lot of people are having issues. Now, one thing we will say is that the numbers have dropped quite a bit. There's been a nice drop of new cases, new infections. Many people are attributing that to increased measures being taken as far as, you know, social distancing and wearing masks and so forth, as well as the vaccine. We're getting penetration now in the parts of the country, and there is a substantial number of people who are, you know, less affected by the virus. So we are getting penetration as far as the vaccine. It's estimated about 16% of the U.S. population has been vaccinated currently. We're seeing also other countries getting even higher numbers. So that is leading to what we believe is a decrease in the number of new infections and especially the deaths due to more people being vaccinated and the viral not being as new to the immune systems of various citizens as it was before. So that being said, USA is still leading the pack. USA is still the number one nation as far as new infections. A little over 80,000 infections per day, so that's actually a lot better than it was earlier in January, where we were looking at hundreds of thousands per day. Still averaging a lot of deaths, unfortunately, as a lot of those people who were infected early in January are still having issues and succumbing to the infection. So over 2,000 deaths still being noted daily. So again, United States citizens, the pandemic is still very much active, despite the vaccines already being rolled out. Many people are still getting sick and unfortunately dying from this virus. So very important, especially for my U.S. citizens, to please pay attention and stay safe out there, guys. Now, India's number two. Now, India has been also having a lot of issues with their issues as far as new infections. They also have relatively low numbers, though, given their billion-plus population. And that being said, they're still having a little over 14,000 new cases per day, about 100 deaths. So very low death rate in India. And they've kind of had that consistently. So a lot of things being looked at as far as why certain regions have low death rates as opposed to others who are having much, much higher death rates. Brazil, number three, about 50,000 new cases per day, about 1,000 deaths per day, a little over 10,000 cases total, or 10 million cases total. So definitely Brazil, been going through, as we've stated many times previously. Russia, number four, about 4 million total cases. They're getting about 13,000 deaths per day. And they're also averaging about a little over 400 deaths per day. So, you know, they're still going through it. They've kind of hung around those few hundred deaths per day, 10 or so thousand new infections for the past few months. So they're kind of still moving along, I should say. Now, the good news is that their vaccine in Russia recently came out as far as data showing that it was 91% effective in preventing severe illness and death as far as people who received it. And that was called, again, that was a Sputnik vaccine that we talked about a few shows ago regarding how Russia has responded. And they were, again, we're the first to market, I should say, that put up the Sputnik vaccine. And they pushed it early, and they've seen, actually, it appears, fairly good results. Now, that being said, for a nation of 145 million, they've only had about 4 million cases total. So they never really were hit as hard as the United States were, but it will be interesting to see if this vaccine, you know, as it penetrates the Russian population, if you'll see that death rate really drop off. It's held about steady since actually the pandemic, so it's interesting to see if these vaccinations will help reduce those numbers even further. Number five is UK at about 4 million cases total. They're about 12,000 cases per day and about 500 deaths. So the nation of UK is definitely going through it, given the size compared to the Russian state. It's definitely, again, UK is about 68 million, so about half the size, a little under half, and they're still having those deaths almost as the size of a state, twice as big. So the UK is definitely going through it, and they're going to hopefully continue to, you know, tough on and try to continue the measures that have enabled them to, you know, get to this point as far as getting the numbers down and keeping them down. Even though they're still high, they're much lower than they would have been had they been a completely wide open society. So we'll keep following those developments as we proceed. All right, guys, so many people believe that once receiving the vaccine that they are officially immune from the coronavirus, meaning that they cannot get another infection. The reality is that there is a very real chance that if you are vaccinated, you can still definitely get infected. Now, the good news is that if you are vaccinated, the chances of you having a very severe infection or severe complication or even dying is substantially reduced. So that is really the main kind of benefit we're seeing with people who have been vaccinated. And there's many reasons behind that. Many studies have been coming out now. One study came out of Israel that looked at those who received the Pfizer vaccine. Now, Israel actually has a very high penetration. It's believed about 60% of people in Israel have been vaccinated against the coronavirus. And given those numbers, they make a great study as far as monitoring those who get the infection, how do they progress, and those who get the vaccine and then get infected, you know, monitoring their progress, seeing how they develop, how they, you know, if they get worse, if they get better, and comparing that to those who did not get the vaccine. And at this point, the data is very clear. Those getting the vaccine have substantially reduced complications. They're getting less sick. And it's really, I think, a hallmark as far as how effective the vaccine has been. Now, one thing we say that because, you know, people say the numbers are very high, we should expect little to no infections. That's not reality. Reality is that even though, for instance, the Pfizer vaccine has 95% of efficacy, meaning that in 95% of patients who receive the vaccine, again, those people will develop antibodies and immunity to the coronavirus. That being said, with the mutations we hear about going on every other week, and we know that this virus mutates, it doesn't mean that you're going to be completely immune. But what it should mean is that there's a huge chance that if you do get sick, you're going to have a mild illness and you recover it quickly. So, and that's actually a great thing. We want to make sure that we get this coronavirus to a point where it becomes a mild illness. Once vaccinated, it becomes something that's, you know, hardly discussed, like measles, mumps, rubella, polio, or all the other vaccinations that have eliminated other diseases that were previously scourges on the population. So, you know, that's what we hope, that one day coronavirus will be, based on the vaccine's effectiveness, that it'll be kind of an afterthought in our minds, not an overarching news story that we talk about every week. So let's hope this vaccine continues to do what it does, and get people, you know, strong against this, you know, infection, so that we're not talking about deaths every day like we've been doing. And that's the hope. And hopefully, you know, when things are done, you know, effectively, and people are vaccinated, you know, we should, you know, hopefully not have a whole segment on the coronavirus, because that's unfortunately the reality that we're dealing with this current pandemic. So a new study suggests that all the participants in the clinical trials that we are basing our data that we're currently, you know, talking about, like the 90% biotech, Pfizer, vaccine, and the Moderna numbers, all of those numbers are based off of predominantly white test subjects. And so this is something that's been discovered in a recent report that was issued by the Harvard Medical School, Fred Hutchinson's Cancer Research Center in Seattle, as well as the Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta. So this joint effort was done, and it showed that the vast majority of people in all the clinical trials that were used to create the data that we use today as the standard of effectiveness regarding whatever vaccine we're discussing were majority Caucasians. 78% of those, as far as how they judged or documented their race, were white. Latinos, who are 18% of the population, were only 12% of the participants in the same study. And Black Americans, who are about 12% of the U.S. population, were only about 11%. So again, the numbers do show that the numbers are definitely skewed toward the Caucasian population. This could be problematic as far as predicting morbidity, mortality, and vaccine effectiveness when looking at, you know, large numbers, large scale populations. This actually has been shown to actually been exposed as far as some of the potential differences in efficacy in different racial populations. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine, for instance, has been shown to be less effective in certain African populations, namely South Africa, where certain test results were done in various clinical trials in that country. And it showed that the vaccine had a markedly decreased efficacy rate when compared to some of the other Caucasian populations. So again, these numbers are kind of interesting because if we start seeing disparities as far as effectiveness on a large scale, it could mean increased potential severity, increased complications in minority populations. So again, we're going to keep monitoring this phenomenon, but again, this thing has been discovered again by these two research institutions, and as they continue to modify the vaccine and come up with new variants of the vaccine, you know, as we stated last week, or 2 weeks prior, I should say, people who were looking at the South African variant and the UK variant of the coronavirus, they're looking at making sure the newer vaccines that are going to come out can include those mutations. And this is hopefully something that will also be done to make sure there's, you know, effectiveness and, you know, inclusion of those other potential differences in different racial groups to make sure the vaccine is effective across the board. And of course, that should be tested as well in racially diverse clinical trials. So again, the hope is that these numbers will continue to be magnified so that when future trials are conducted and future vaccines are created, these racial disparities are taken into account to ensure that, you know, we get the best outcome across all groups with these vaccines. So again, we're going to be monitoring the situation closely, and of course, if anything develops, we will definitely bring it to you. Are you a coffee lover like me? Well, new study shows that potentially overconsumption of coffee can lead to potentially increased rates of heart disease. Well, a study out of the Australian Center for Precision Health, they looked at, you know, how much coffee potentially could cause problems in other areas. So what they did was they looked at people who were heavy drinkers, and they defined a heavy drinker by someone who drinks about 6 cups or more of coffee a day. So they looked at these people with coffee, who were heavy drinkers, I should say, and they looked at over 300,000 people. So a very large study. This was in the UK. Looked at a bunch of folks who drank a lot of coffee, looked at their habits. They ranged in age from 37 to 73, right? And they found that those who were known to be heavy drinkers, again, more than 6 cups of coffee a day, were found to have elevated plasma lipid levels. Now, the reason why this is important is because people who have higher levels of lipid plasma are potentially at increased risk for, again, heart attacks. Now, the study that we've been looking at previously has shown that elevated high cholesterol or elevated cholesterol levels can lead to increased risk of heart disease and heart attack, I should say, as well as stroke even. Now, the problem with caffeine is that, or coffee is that there's a compound in coffee known as cafestol. It's actually a common compound found in coffee. And it's important because this chemical has been shown to potentially stimulate increased lipid production when consumed. Now, this is a very small effect, especially in normal amounts of coffee. So it's not something you should get worried about if you're drinking 1 cup. But if you're consuming like 6, 8, 10 cups a day, which is excessive by any standard, this lipid issue could potentially be a problem. And this Australian study showed that those who were known to drink heavy amounts were having these elevated lipid levels, and they believed that this compound cafestol is partly to blame. Now, again, they didn't control for the entire diet, so who knows if people who were also heavy drinkers were also heavy eaters and were eating, you know, heavily, you know, high cholesterol meals daily, or at high amounts per day, leading to those numbers being elevated. So it's hard to say if caffeine is a direct link, but between, you know, this kind of correlation is being made, there's a possible link, and this cafestol could explain it. Now, of course, more research needs to be done. You know, I would say if you're someone who drinks a lot of coffee, like 6 or more, probably look at bringing it down to maybe less than 3, just because, you know, ultimately coffee, you know, is also a stimulant as well. Can cause, you know, other issues, especially cardiac problems. If you're prone to having, you know, what we call dysrhythmias, which is called abnormal heart rhythms, you know, you can potentially have issues with that. So, you know, the ultimate story, or the ultimate, you know, kind of takeaway here is everything in moderation. You know, you want to kind of make sure you're not overdoing it. You know, if you're drinking about 3 cups a day, you're probably doing great. You know, over 6 has been shown to potentially be problematic, especially over a long period of time. So just again, everything in moderation. Let's kind of not overdo it, and let's kind of, you know, take it easy, if you will. So, and ultimately, if you're drinking a lot of coffee to stay awake, just take a nap. And taking a nap, even 30 minutes, can be more effective and a lot healthier than drinking coffee. So again, you know, everything in moderation. And if you're truly tired, where you're drinking 10 cups to stay awake, probably time to take a rest. You know, your body is telling you that for a reason. So we stated before in the show, there was an issue in Texas where there was essentially freezing temperatures for about 4 to 5 days, temperatures below 20 degrees for sustained periods of time. And this led to extremely treacherous conditions throughout the state. You know, Texas is usually normally used to hot, warm climates. So this entire kind of fiasco really exposed some of the weaknesses that were found in the grid, which is, again, the system that controls the power infrastructure in the state. So one thing that was seen was that there were a lot of blackouts, rolling blackouts throughout the various days during this freeze. The reason why this is concerning, because when there are blackouts and there's no power and the temperature is below, you know, 32 degrees, that puts you in a potentially dangerous situation. You have freezing temperatures and no way to warm yourselves. Now, unfortunately, most people aren't used to camping, going outdoors and lighting fires and whatnot. Most people are used to putting on a, hitting a switch and something turns on. You know, this has led to people becoming very used to the modern conveniences of a developed nation. Now, that being said, when this blackout happened, combined with the cold temperatures, it led to a very dangerous situation and a very, you know, treacherous situation for those. And it is coming to find out more and more that the increased dangers were increasingly or disproportionately found in low-income, non-white communities. And the reason why this is problematic, because it kind of further exposes the concept of environmental racism. And this is where, you know, communities of color, Black Americans especially, are being, you know, put in environments in various, especially southern states, where they're in parts of the town that are potentially next to hazardous, you know, environmental issues like landfills or, you know, animal farms or you know, toxic waste dumps, things like that. And it's even shown that the various, you know, grid, you know, infrastructure setups in these communities are also not up to snuff, leading to a lot of these communities suffering prolonged blackouts that weren't seen in some of the more affluent communities in these areas. So, and this is actually concerning development, especially when it comes to health and wellness, because, you know, if you're in an environment that's potentially very toxic, meaning you're living next to a landfill with all kinds of hazardous chemicals, or next to a factory that's spewing toxic fumes into the air, you know, this is gonna definitely affect your health. So the fact that now, when there was a natural disaster and power and water were lost for many, many days, and even longer for those in, you know, poor, disenfranchised communities, it shows that, you know, if the danger of living in many communities is very high, and things that you cannot even control are constantly affecting your ability to be well. So people should definitely look at some of these issues and look at, you know, further exposing some of these environmental issues that are leading to increased health issues in, you know, poor, especially non-white communities. So again, the power grid, the blackouts were another example of what we term as environmental racism that are affecting those, especially in these, you know, communities that are have been disenfranchised for many, many decades. A breakthrough study has recently been released that showed a potential unique finding that's been seen in patients who are more likely to have increased complications from COVID-19 infection. There was some research done, and it was recently published in a Journal of Science, that showed that, you know, 10% of people who had COVID 10% of those who developed life-threatening complications after getting COVID, I should say, were found that they had an issue with their immune system that was resulted from a defective interferon, which is typically one of the compounds that usually fight infection. So essentially, people who had more complications were found to be deficient in a certain interferon in their immune system that's normally needed to fight infections effectively. That being said, it shows that those who were really sick or had a higher rate of complications were found to have an increased likelihood of not having this compound, this interferon. So this shows that, you know, there were some people who actually not have a problem with coronavirus. They'll get the infection, they'll clear it before it became a problem. And it was shown that certain folks have immune systems that are a little more robust and able to kind of neutralize the virus before it got out of hand. However, other individuals, especially those being identified in the study, and this study was fairly small, only 1,000 COVID patients they looked at, and 10% of those patients who were critically ill got or had a deficiency in this interferon. So again, it shows that there's some issues potentially at a genetic level that could explain some of the differences between those who are getting sick and those who are not. And so hopefully more research will be done on these immune system issues, and that will lead to more effective and more, you know, hopefully, you know, awesome treatments designed to, you know, reduce some of the complications and death that we're seeing with COVID. All right, guys, and before we end the show, I want to say one awesome other development we're noticing today, and of course, health and wellness and nutrition, we're big here too, so I want to bring it up on our show, and that is the viral sensation of foo-foo TikTok, everybody. Have you guys seen the blow-up of African cuisine we're seeing on social media? TikTok, YouTube, all sorts of social media influencers are now eating African food as some sort of a, you know, social media phenomenon. They're eating all kinds of delicious foods like egusi soup and pounded yam and semovita with vegetable soup or erigaikon soup and all those delicious African soups, which I'm a big fan of. But they're now bringing it to the masses via social media. So this kind of caught my attention because I thought it was unique in that African cuisine, which I talk about a lot, is one of the better cuisines, I would argue, only because it has a lot of nutritional value. Can make a very easy vegan variant of it if you're into, you know, a no-meat diet. Very nutritious, high in fiber, a lot of things we praise here on this show. So we're going to do a whole expose on the African diet and really break it down as well. But, you know, I'm going to, you know, leave you, I thought, before the end of the show today, some of the funny kind of videos and stuff going on social media regarding, you know, the foo-foo mukbang or the foo-foo, you know, TikToks that are out there, really kind of exposing some of the great kind of sides of African diet. Now, of course, there are haters too, so not everyone loves it. Some people are saying it's, you know, like poop and other stuff, which is, unfortunately, you know, they're a loss. However, you know, I think the overwhelming majority are really loving the cuisine, and, you know, that's one thing I praise or preach on this show a lot. You know, if you want to kind of make sure you're eating as best way you can, don't be afraid to try other cuisines. You know, a lot of cultures have been out here putting great food dishes together, using their flair, their seasonings, their cultural kind of tastes, and it's resulting in a lot of awesome cuisines. I mean, Greece has an amazing cuisine. Those who are not used to, you know, Greek food, Mediterranean food, I highly suggest you visit a Mediterranean restaurant in your area. Ethiopian food is delicious, Indian food is delicious, all sorts of African cuisines from, you know, Senegal, Uganda, South Africa, of course, Nigeria, a lot of delicious cuisines all throughout many nations, all throughout the globe. So don't be afraid to try new foods, guys. Don't be afraid to try new foods, guys. It's so important to expand your cultural, your cultural kind of, you know, palate, if you will. And it'll really kind of allow you to really experience the culture even before visiting it. So I always tell folks, especially if you're thinking about going to a country, first you can do is go to your local variant restaurant in your local area to kind of experience that culture. And the best way to do that, honestly, is through the food. So again, hopefully this, you know, African cuisine explosion will, you know, allow it to become more popular. And I think that if people kind of adopt it more, it can result in a lot of beneficial things, especially improve health and wellness and other, you know, great, awesome developments. So again, that's all for today's show. I want to thank you guys for tuning in to the Health and Wellness Connection. We are going to hopefully bring more exciting content for you guys every week, barring no more, life-ending natural disasters, which seems to happen all the time here in Houston. We can hopefully keep bringing you that content that you guys hopefully are appreciating. So again, I'm Dr. Barry, the host. Thanks for joining us today. We will see you guys next week on the next episode of the Health and Wellness Connection TV show. Peace.